From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We'll start the hour in the Bahamas, which is assessing the devastation from Hurricane Dorian. More than 40 people are now confirmed dead a week after the storm hit. And as rescue and recovery efforts continue, the death toll is expected to rise. Hundreds, at least, are still missing. Joining us now is NPR's Jason Beaubien, who's in Cherokee near Marsh Harbor on Great Abaco Island. That's one of the hardest hit areas. Jason, it's been a week now since Dorian hit. We're still hearing about no electricity, no running water. What is it like where you are today?
So, you know, the sun's actually out today, and you can see why this is such a beautiful destination for so many people. But when you get into Marsh Harbor itself, the destruction is just sort of mind-blowing. I mean, entire neighborhoods just wiped out. And part of what's interesting now is it's getting sort of like calm and sort of quiet because so many people have cleared out. They've managed to push most of the rubble away from the streets so that vehicles can get through, and there's some search and rescue crews going through there. But there's actually sort of a creepy silence in some parts of Marsh Harbor that are just, you know, rubble, but very few people around.
Well, and we were hearing reports just a few days ago from reporters who had made it to where you are, who said that there were still bodies in the rubble. Are you still seeing that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you unfortunately can smell it. And as you move through areas, you can just smell that there's rotting bodies. And that's even how the search and rescue crews, we talked to some of them yesterday, said that they are identifying where some of these bodies are is by smell. So, yes, there are definitely still bodies in the rubble there.
In terms of getting people out and getting people to either the capital, Nassau, or to even the United States, how have those efforts been going?
So there's an improvement on that. They're sending ferries. There's a mail boat that goes back and forth to Nassau that they were able to get quite a few people on. They also have this thing called the Fast Ferry. They've been loading people onto that. Some flights have been going. Delta is actually just doing some shuttles just between here and Nassau. You know, there's some small private planes. Many people still are having a hard time getting off the island. People just on their own are contacting people in Spanish Wells, which is on another island, and getting boats to come over and pick them up. Not everybody has managed to get out who wants to get out. There's also people who still aren't accepting the fact that they're going to have to leave. There are people who are, there's a lot of Haitians here. Mm-hmm. I was talking to one guy yesterday. He had just gotten a work permit, spent $6,000 to get a work permit for another 3 years to stay here, and he doesn't want to leave because he just spent all his money. There's other Haitians who don't have the proper immigration permits, and they're worried that if they go to Nassau, they're going to get deported back to Haiti. And then there's just some Bahamians who don't want to accept that there is no power, there is no water, and that it's going to be a long time before they're able to survive here.
Jason, finally, you've reported from so many places that have been hit hard by natural disasters or man-made disasters. How does this feel in comparison?
You know, certainly when you're standing in the middle of Marsh Harbor right now, this looks like, you know, one of the worst disasters that I've ever seen. You know, just rubble for as far as you can see. You know, the force of these winds compare to Typhoon Haiyan that hit the Philippines and really just destroyed Tacloban. You know, this was an unbelievably powerful storm. People talk about just the winds howling outside as it pounded them. I mean, people telling us stories about just being completely surrounded in water, you know, more than 10 feet of water rushing through Marsh Harbor. And there were people in that just clinging to trees and fences and things trying to survive. So, you know, and certainly for the people who are here, they're saying this is the worst disaster that they have ever been through or ever seen in the Bahamas. And they're also trying to overcome that trauma as well as rebuild their houses, figure out, you know, where they're going next.
That is NPR's Jason Beaubien near Marsh Harbor on Great Abaco Island in the Bahamas. Jason, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, President Trump will be in Fayetteville, North Carolina later today to drum up support for Republican candidates trying to fill the only two empty seats in the House of Representatives. There are two special elections tomorrow. One is a race for the vacant 3rd District seat left open by the death of longtime Republican Congressman Walter Jones. The other is in the 9th District, a redo of that 2018 contest tainted by ballot tampering. As Rusty Jacobs of member station WUNC reports, the election may be a bellwether for a key state in 2020.
Dan McCready has been running to represent North Carolina's 9th congressional district for more than 2 years.
I actually measure it in terms of number of kids. So I had 3 when we started, and I got 4 now. Believe it or not. My oldest is 8, and my youngest, Eleanor, just turned 2 a few weeks ago. She was born after we started this campaign.
The Democrat is addressing about 24 supporters gathered at a campaign office in Hamlet, a small North Carolina town in Richmond County. McCready ran for the seat last year against Republican Mark Harris. After Election Day, he trailed Harris by just over 900 votes. But an investigation by the State Elections Board found a contractor for the Harris campaign had instructed workers to illegally handle people's absentee ballots in Bladen County. The board ordered a new election. The scandal is clearly motivating McCready supporters like Lois Jones, a Richmond County Democrat.
It's just shameful. You know, you think elections are free and honest, but we're finding out that they're not, from the 2016 election to this election, and I think it's going to motivate more people just to come out.
North Carolina's 9th district is shaped like a golf putter, sitting along the border with South Carolina, crossing 8 counties. One of them is Cumberland County, and its Republican Party chairman, Jonathan Strange, calls it one of the state's craziest districts.
Economically different, you know, when you are closer to the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, you still have a lot of business, service-based economy. But as soon as you cross that line and start moving into Union County, you automatically start moving into more of an agricultural, rural area.
Strange says GOP candidate Dan Bishop's advantage over Democrat Dan McCready lies with Bishop's clarity of message.
You know where Dan Bishop's going to vote. He's told you, I'm a Trump Republican.
Bishop made that clear in a recent one-on-one debate with McCready, answering a question about immigration.
President Trump is right. We need a border wall. We need a barrier so that we do not have illegals under those circumstances entering the United States and then have to be dealt with in terms of detention over the long term.
And Bishop assailed McCready for supporting a veto by North Carolina's Democratic governor of a bill that would have required sheriffs to honor federal immigration enforcement detention orders for inmates in local jails.
The governor vetoed that bill because the governor favors sanctuary city policy, and Dan McCready said the governor made the right call. Wrong, Dan.
As much as Bishop and Republicans would like to lump McCready in with a demonized progressive wing of Democrats, including Congresswomen Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Maxine Waters, the Iraq War veteran and Marine is running a middle-of-the-road, let's-rise-above-the-divisive rhetoric campaign. His slogan is country over party. On health care, McCready favors fixing Obamacare, not Medicare for all.
Every single one of the proposals in my plan are nonpartisan. They're all ideas to bring down the cost of health care and protect people with pre-existing conditions and work with Republicans and Democrats to do it.
And on guns and public safety, McCready supports what he calls common sense solutions like comprehensive background checks, but not a ban on assault weapons.
We've also got to look at what we can get done right now. Washington's a very broken place. Just about nothing's getting done at all up there. And anything that's coming out of the House of Representatives right now is dead on arrival with Mitch McConnell.
At the debate, Bishop, a staunch gun rights advocate, surprisingly said he wouldn't rule out the need for some kind of weapons prohibition, but offered no specifics. He did hedge on the idea of red flag laws, which would allow courts to keep guns from people deemed to be a danger to themselves or others.
I have grave concern in administrative practice for whether liberal judges who have taken so much on themselves to carry out in terms of activism might use such a power to strip inordinate numbers of people of weapons.
As the candidates approach the finish line, Bishop is getting some late-inning big-name support. President Trump and Vice President Mike Pence are scheduled to visit the state today to help get out the vote. an indication of, one, just how important turnout will be for a neck-and-neck race in an off-year September special election, and two, just how closely the political establishment sees it as a sneak preview for next year, with healthcare and guns among the top concerns for voters. David McLennan teaches political science at Meredith College in Raleigh.
I think this has got a real national flavor in terms of the issues and in terms of the Trump presidency being part of the campaign.
The race also features far less well-funded candidates from the Libertarian and Green Party. For Here and Now, I'm Rusty Jacobs.
And a note now on another story we're following. The Coast Guard is conducting a dramatic rescue operation today off the coast of Georgia, where a 656-foot cargo ship sailing under a Marshall Islands flag and carrying a load of vehicles began listing early Sunday morning. It's capsized now, and the massive ship is now floating on its side like a giant whale. We'll have pictures at hereandnow.org. The Coast Guard says 20 of the 24 people on board have been rescued. Four were missing, but the Coast Guard now says they've drilled a hole and made contact with them. They're inside. We'll follow this Here and Now. Best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell likes to take a fresh look at things we assume we know about. So books like Blink and The Tipping Point looked at how little things can have a big effect or at how we make decisions. Now, Gladwell is looking at the assumptions we make when we talk to strangers. We think if someone is shifting, seems furtive, they're lying, right? Well, research shows not true. If someone doesn't show remorse, they're guilty, right? Well, Gladwell reminds us of Amanda Knox, cleared of a murder charge in Italy, a charge Gladwell says was because she didn't act the way strangers thought she should. Poet Sylvia Plath makes an appearance. Gladwell says she illustrates something called coupling, behavior coupled with context. So maybe Plath only committed suicide because she could. When the gas oven she used was outlawed in the UK, suicides dropped. And more controversially, Gladwell points to Sandra Bland, the African-American woman pulled over for failing to signal by the white Texas police officer Brian Ancinia. She was upset. He handcuffed her. 3 days later, she committed suicide in jail. And was this racism, as many say? Or, as Gladwell says, a complete misuse of a system of talking to strangers that worked well for police in Kansas City? Malcolm Gladwell's book is Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. And Malcolm, you say, we view strangers as simple to understand, but ourselves, we're complicated, we're nuanced.
Yes. When it comes to judgments about our own character and behavior, we are willing to entertain all manner of complexity and subtlety. When it comes to making those same judgments about others, we are depressingly simplistic.
We default to not being able to believe that somebody could be a bad person. You write about a famous example, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain meeting with Adolf Hitler, 1938, convinced he wouldn't invade Czechoslovakia. But you say that this idea that we default to assuming that people are telling us the truth is also the thing that lubricates the wheels of society. And we couldn't function if we were constantly doubting people.
Yeah, the book is built in part on the ideas of a really brilliant psychologist named Tim Levine. And he says that occasional deception is the price of civil society. In other words, we shouldn't be so quick to condemn ourselves or others when we're victims of deception. We should instead understand that that's just the unavoidable side effect of something really important about human nature.
Well, because if we were doubting everybody all the time, we'd be like a man that you describe who ends up barricading himself in his home because he feels he's going to be murdered by Bernie Madoff or Bernie Madoff supporters because he's the one who figures out that Bernie Madoff is committing a huge Ponzi scheme. But once, having used his skills to figure that out, he's a tortured person.
Yeah. The world doesn't work if we're all filled with so much suspicion that we're capable of seeing the truth about a person like Madoff. It's a very interesting and kind of subtle trade-off that I wish we had a better understanding of.
No. But one of the things he tells you is something that judges think about and that others think about, Neville Chamberlain might have thought about. He doesn't want to meet somebody face to face because he's afraid that he will go to that truth default, that he'll try to see something good in that person. And you profile a double agent for Cuba. Nobody suspected her, the double agent, Ana Montes, possibly being a spy because they didn't want to see it.
Yeah. And when you realize that even an agency like, for example, the CIA, which is presumably one of the most sophisticated group of people around and who have devoted enormous amounts of attention and energy and resources to the detection and uncovering of spies, when you realize that they are so easily duped, then you understand the kind of what we're up against as human beings. And that there are many things, many conclusions one can draw from that. One is it raises the question of why we bother spying. If it's impossible to detect spies, shouldn't we just get out of the business of spying? And that's actually a very, very serious point. But the larger point is that we have to, I think, come to grips as human beings, and this is one of the arguments in the book, with our fundamental weaknesses when it comes to making sense of strangers. We cannot swagger into our confrontations with strangers with the confidence that we can make sense of them in the moment. There just is no evidence that we are good at that task.
Well, there's so much here. The sitcom Friends makes an appearance because you asked to study the faces of the stars of the sitcom Friends because the actors' emotions, and when you think about it, it's true, they are so telegraphed, so transparent is a word that we hear about a lot. So you see when somebody's angry, upset, scared, and yet that's not how real life is. We don't express ourselves that way.
There's a profound difference between fictional representations of emotion and real life representations of emotion. And when psychologists have studied this, they've found that only very infrequently is there this perfect match between our expressions and our feelings. Now, that doesn't matter when you're dealing with a friend because we become very aware of their idiosyncrasies. When it comes to strangers, we don't have that kind of inside knowledge. And that opens the door to all manner of misinterpretation. That's a big theme in the book, this idea of how much transparency is a problem in the way we behave.
Well, and the secondary theme maybe could also be that how theories about interacting with strangers might work in one context. If they're abused or taken out of that context, they don't work. And that takes us back to the police work in Kansas City, when the thinking was, let's couple, you know, tons of police officers knocking on doors, but also, you know, pulling people over in just the few blocks where the crime is. And people will welcome it, and they did, and the crime will fall, and it did. But that theory of pulling people over as many as possible for the smallest of infractions was then picked up by this Texas police officer who pulled over Sandra Bland in a completely different area, suburban area. And it, you know, as you say, he'd done this maybe every 15 minutes for the past several hours. He'd been just pulling people over, abusing that coupling. And you say not understanding Sandra Bland.
Yeah. The Sandra Bland case is really about the same thing I've been talking about in these other cases, which is it is an example of our failure to communicate effectively with strangers, that the cop epically misunderstands Sandra Bland, and that has catastrophic consequences. When we talk about the Sandra Bland case, the most common explanation is that it's an example of what happened when racist ideas find their way into law enforcement. And I think that's absolutely true. But what I wanted to do was to dig a little deeper and say maybe this is an example of how some fundamental ideas that we have in our head about how to deal with strangers are ill-suited for the real world. So transparency, that I've just been talking about, is one of them. The cop makes assumptions about how Sandra Bland, who she is and how she's feeling, based on her emotional expressions and body language. That is, when it comes to dealing with strangers, an exercise fraught with danger.
Well, we go back to all the points that you've been making all along the way in the book, the research that shows that we can't pick out the person who's lying and we can't pick out the person who's guilty of a crime. We can't. So he imposed some of that thinking on this woman, Sandra Bland, who was angry. She was angry she'd been pulled over. She was angry that he was asking her to get out of the car. He was being, as you said, a bully who was fired.
And misinterpreted her anger as he thought she was dangerous. So this is a classic example of misreading strangers. And there, you know, that I begin and end with this question of policing, because I think these ideas that I explore in the book apply very powerfully to modern policing, that we're asking police in American society to do something very, very difficult and very, very ambitious, which is we're asking them to aggressively intervene in the daily lives of millions of Americans and make accurate judgments about what those Americans are up to and in so doing prevent crime. My argument in this book is that that is an impossible task.
But I just want to ask you, Malcolm Gladwell, again, the book is just stuffed with scholarly research and experiments. But some people might say you went a long way to then characterize the Sandra Bland encounter as a mistake between strangers, when for them it is flat-out racism.
But they're the same thing, aren't they?
Are they?
What is racism? It is a strategy we use to characterize a stranger, right? It is one of a number of different ways in which one privileged group, a majority group, chooses to make sense of a minority group, of a group without power. So what I'm trying to do is to take that fundamental impulse and dig down a little bit and say, well, what are the components of those powerful and consequential racist reactions? And I think you can make a very strong case that this philosophy of policing that underlies things like the traffic stop of Sandra Bland, but also hundreds of thousands of other of these aggressive and ultimately, I think, socially malicious traffic stops by police officers, is a way in which policing has represented and codified racist attitudes. So why would you jump to a conclusion about a young African-American woman driving lawfully down a street in the middle of the day in a middle-class community in Texas? You'd only jump to that conclusion if you had in the back of your mind some larger sense about how implicitly dangerous young black people were, right? This is why, you know, the project of the book was really to take something that is very broad and vague, like racism, and say, how is that codified in something like law enforcement?
Malcolm Gladwell, the new book is Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. Malcolm, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
So there's his take on Sandra Bland, his thought on a well-known college rape case being at its heart an inability to read strangers coupled with alcohol is also raising eyebrows. Your thoughts? Is everything about speaking with strangers? Go to hearnow.org. Oh, what a gut-wrenching night at the U.S. Open. Center court turned into a boxing ring. Rafael Nadal, drenched in sweat, his fingers covered in Band-Aids, facing the newcomer, Russia's Daniil Medvedev, punching the ball back and forth like prizefighters in a five-set, nearly five-hour match. Finally, Nadal collapsed, spread-eagled and victorious.
Nadal!
Game set and match Nadal. 3-6-2.
And many of us watching hadn't yet recovered from the emotional day before. Serena Williams failing to win her 24th singles title, falling to the 19-year-old Canadian Bianca Andreescu, who seemingly came from nowhere. David Wallstein of the New York Times covered it all. David, Nadal, Medvedev, some of the best tennis you've ever seen?
Yeah, it was some of the most compelling tennis I've ever seen. At times, the quality of play wasn't at its height, but that was okay because they were trying so hard. And the swings in that match were incredible. I mean, at first I thought, okay, Nadal's winning in three sets, no problem. Then after Medvedev's comeback, I was like, oh, he's going to win. And I actually started writing in a panic. I started writing a Daniil Medvedev upsets Rafael Nadal story. And then Nadal breaks his serve back again in the fifth set. What an event.
Yeah. We'll talk about Medvedev for a second. Nadal did win the first two sets. Do you think we actually watched this, you know, newcomer who had been, you know, the bad guy over the week,
He'd flipped the finger to the crowd. He was nasty to a ball boy, took a towel. He taunted the crowd, you know. Come on, Boomy. Something happened, though, in the middle of this. Did we watch somebody become a player they hadn't been before?
Well, I don't know if he became a player, but I think what happened was people actually saw the real Daniil Medvedev. The sort of ornery guy that was taunting the crowd, that was an aberration. I mean, he said, he told the fans afterwards, he said, you know, during the third set, I was thinking about what I was going to say in my loser's speech for 20 minutes.
As you say, though, he also seemed to, you know, go into a new gear of play. But Nadal persevered and wept at the end when they showed video from his previous 19 titles. This is his fourth U.S. Open. Where does this put him, do you think?
Oh, he's going to pass Federer next year, I think, or at least catch. He's going to catch Federer next year. I don't think Federer would be the favorite to win the Australian Open. So if he doesn't, Nadal would be the overwhelming favorite to win the French Open. And that would tie him with Federer at 20.
But you have to watch out for newcomers like Medvedev, which I just want to ask you, Serena Williams is well aware of now. Here we had Canada's Bianca Andreescu beating Serena Williams. Serena didn't seem on her game. You know, comment on that just briefly.
You know, this is the fourth straight time that Serena Williams, since she's come back from giving birth, has reached a final, but then can't even win a set in those finals. She's 0-8 in sets in those finals. So I think nerves get the better part of her in the finals. It's just so intense because she's trying to catch Margaret Court with 24 Grand Slam titles.
Right. Well, and then you also had that 19-year-old, really something, Bianca Andreescu.
She was something. Andreescu is a fierce, fierce competitor. She's not afraid of anything, and she's going to win a lot more of these.
David Wallstein of the New York Times, thanks so much.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Congress is back in session today after a six-week recess. House lawmakers will try to pass gun control measures, avoid a government shutdown at the end of the month, and launch more investigations into President Trump. Meanwhile, the White House is defending its decision to cancel a secret summit between Taliban leaders and the president of Afghanistan and President Trump. Questions are swirling in Washington and around the world about how the meeting came together and why it fell apart. Let's bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro in Washington. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told NBC's Chuck Todd yesterday on Meet the Press that the meeting with the Taliban was scrapped and that peace talks with the Taliban are dead for now. Let's listen.
Does this mean talks are off completely?
So for the time being, that's absolutely the case. We've recalled Ambassador Khalilzad back to Washington. We've been working on this problem set for a number of months now and frankly had made real progress with the Government of National Unity, President Ghani, as well as with the Taliban.
Now, Trump first made the announcement that he was canceling the meeting on Twitter Saturday night, saying he canceled after a recent Taliban attack killed a U.S. soldier. Afterward, the Taliban said the two sides had come very close to a deal. What does all this mean for the planned withdrawal of U.S. troops in Afghanistan?
It's not clear, really. I mean, this was supposed to be part of a deal with the Taliban if there was going to be one. Or, you know, President Trump could go on his own, just like we've seen a number of times before, him kind of waver and waffle on an issue and maybe even decide to go unilaterally. But, you know, there's a lot of the details here are completely unclear. It's not clear why or how this wound up getting canceled, because there certainly have been a number of attacks from the Taliban. And this was not even the worst of them.
Now, in terms of Congress, Domenico, the summer recess is over. Lawmakers are back on Capitol Hill today. What are you going to be watching for, and specifically when it comes to possible gun control after the mass shootings we've seen while Congress has been on recess?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the shutdown and avoiding one is, of course, you know, the big piece of all of this. It's sort of like just being able to try to get normal business done, keep the lights on in government is a bit of a chore nowadays. But guns and impeachment are really top of the agenda. And does this, you know, mean that Democrats may go after impeachment? And will there be anything that passes on guns?
Will there be anything that passes on guns?
I look into my crystal ball here, and it's fuzzy, Jeremy.
It's fuzzy. Okay.
You know, the ball is in President Trump's court. Democrats are going to push for this. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he's going to defer to President Trump. And there really is no indication that President Trump is going to move to, say, even move on universal background checks, something that has universal praise pretty much and support from people on on the Republican side and on the Democratic side. And President Trump has kind of waffled and wavered on this. And there's no indication that he's going to actually push for this. And the ball is in his court. And it's going to be interesting. We have a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that comes out tomorrow afternoon. And we'll see what people think Congress should do and what they should pass when it comes to guns.
In terms of those investigations you talked about, the congressional committees are now looking into corruption to put pressure on Democrats who have not yet backed an impeachment inquiry. What exactly are they looking at, and how much time do Democrats have left to decide if they are going to impeach?
You know, I'd say over the next few months is really how long they've got. They don't want this to drag out into 2020 in the presidential election very long. Just quickly, it's no longer just the special counsel's Russia probe and obstruction of justice, which is what Democrats had been talking about. But they're also looking at these payments to women to cover up alleged affairs, reports that the president had teased pardoning people willing to seize land to build his wall, and whether his businesses had profited from government travel.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro in Washington. Domenico, thanks.
You're so welcome.
Well, have you ever let go of a balloon and watched it float away or released a few dozen balloons for a celebration? In Queen Anne's County, Maryland, intentional releases of non-biodegradable helium balloons are now illegal. Anyone who deliberately violates the ordinance can be fined up to $250. At least five states already have laws restricting balloon releases, but Maryland is not one of them. Joining me now is Queen Anne's County Commissioner Chris Corcorino, who proposed the ban in his county. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell me about this bill that just passed there in Queen Anne's County, Maryland. What does it do, and why did you want to do this?
So I was contacted by one of our local environmental groups. There were balloons being found everywhere. We had on one particular farm, they were finding balloons that were released, and there's a tag in it that said, "We sent these from Ohio. Give us a call if you find it." Hmm. Another farm, they found balloons that were released at the Indianapolis 500. And these pose a threat not just to the environment because they're non-biodegradable, but they get in the waterways and birds and other animals can get ensnared in them and they can't get free. They land in farms and they can spook animals. If they land in farms that are not being used for livestock but just for crop rotation, the farmers have to get out of their tractors. They got to move the balloons. And so they suggested that, well, we as a county can do something. We can say we're not going to allow these mass release of balloons in our county. Now, granted, a lot of the balloons that we're finding in our county are probably released somewhere else.
Right.
But what we can do is we can say, send out a signal that we're going to be good neighbors to our neighbors and hope that others will follow along. Releasing balloons off into the air. When I was a kid, we used to do that as a fundraiser at my elementary school. And it looks majestic. You watch them going up into the air. But they don't go into space. They do land back somewhere else. And they're not biodegradable. So they land in somebody else's yard.
Now, last year, researchers in Virginia released a study showing that they had collected more than 11,000 pieces of balloon debris on uninhabited beaches between 2013 and 2017. So obviously, more examples of what you're talking about there. But the executive director of the Balloon Council, Lorna O'Hara, told the Washington Post, it's not the product that harms the environment, it's the misuse that does, and that there's a slippery slope from balloon release bans to balloon bans. What do you say to that?
Well, so I don't think it is a slippery slope because in our county, we're not saying you can't have balloons. I tell people if you want to have balloons at your kid's birthday party or you want to have them at a wedding, get them, tie them securely, and then dispose of them properly when you're done. And we actually specifically put into the bill that the unintentional or sort of negligent release was not going to be punished. So if you're at the carnival and your kid gets a helium balloon and they have slippery fingers and that balloon gets off in the atmosphere, nothing's going to happen to you. Nothing's going to happen to your kid. That's not the kind of behavior that we're targeting. But you do have some weddings and funerals, graduations where people want to release hundreds of balloons into the air. And that's sort of the behavior that we're looking to curb.
What do you say to people who look at this and see it in the same way that they see bans on plastic straws, which is kind of the same issue that you're talking about here, which is that this plastic is not biodegradable. Often it ends up in the oceans or on beaches. But President Trump is out there, you know, giving away or selling plastic straws as a campaign tool because there are a lot of Americans who see that and say, well, why shouldn't I be able to have a plastic straw if I want one? What do you say to people who see this in the same category as that?
Yeah, and people have raised that with me, and I try to explain to them there is a distinct difference here. We're targeting different types of behavior, right? So people aren't releasing plastic straws, right? You're not throwing them into the water on purpose. People are being negligent about them, and the discussion as to whether or not we should have plastic straws or another type of straw, that's not something at the county level that we really get into. But the balloons, this is intentionally releasing it, right? You're intentionally trying to put this into the environment, and then it goes to somebody else's property. So I look at it as more of we're looking at a more specific type of behavior rather than the product itself.
How would you enforce this? Because presumably you wouldn't notice the problem until long after the balloon has been released.
Right. So I had put the idea we could get a secret drone squad out there, but that was shot down by everybody else. So I don't think we're going to get that. The main enforcement mechanism, particularly in Queen Anne's County, is the vast majority of the citizens follow the law. So if you have the law on the books, it's going to be followed. And that's your enforcement mechanism. Could someone go out and get a whole bunch of balloons and go in the middle of a field and release them and never get caught? Sure. We have a lot of wedding venues in our county. So now that this law is there, they know that if a wedding party comes and they want to do a balloon release, they can say, well, here in the county, we can't do that. Here are some other things we could do instead that are not harmful to the environment. And then they can explain why we have this ordinance. And when we explain this to people, they say, oh, you know what? That makes sense. I hadn't thought about that. Mm-hmm. Is this going to save the world? No. And we're not saying that it is. But it's a little thing that we can do to curb a behavior that's unnecessary.
That is Chris Corcorino, who's a member of the Board of Commissioners in Queen Anne's County, Maryland, which just passed a ban on intentionally releasing balloons. Commissioner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your interest in Queen Anne's County.
Fracking for oil and natural gas is changing the landscape in more than a dozen states around the country, transforming open space and countryside into industrial zones, some landowners making big money, maybe for the first time, leasing their underground mineral rights. But in eastern Ohio, thousands of new well pads haven't been welcomed by everyone. As the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports, people who don't want to lease their land don't always have a choice.
In 2010, a land agent from an energy company knocked on Patrick Hunkler and his wife Jean Bax's door, and it changed their lives.
Well, you know, I didn't know much about fracking.
He offered them $137 an acre for the mineral rights under their 21 acres in Belmont County in eastern Ohio.
$137, that's probably the closest I ever came to signing a lease at $137.
They got 100 calls after that and were badgered by agents stopping by the house. By 2014, they were being offered $8,500 an acre. Jean Beck says the money might have been nice, but she'd heard about water and air pollution from fracking.
No, I would have preferred to not sign a lease.
But still, her husband was open to the idea if the lease protected the air, water, and dark night sky.
We would express our environmental concerns and, hey, we'd like this in the lease. That was never addressed. The only thing that they could offer us was money.
So they decided not to sign. Then in 2017, they got a notice from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, also known as ODNR. Chesapeake Energy was seeking to unitize their property. That meant the state could force the family to sign a lease allowing Chesapeake to drill for gas under their property. The company declined an interview for this story. Heidi Robertson is a professor of law and environmental studies at Cleveland State University. She's researched and written about unitization in Ohio.
We normally think of the rights of the landowner as being things like the right to decide what's done with your land or what's not done with your land.
But Robertson says that's not necessarily the case in Ohio when it comes to drilling for oil and natural gas. That's because the state adopted a unitization law in 1965 with requirements for the size and shape of land where a well can be drilled. These are called units, which usually range from 300 to 1,100 acres. Robertson says one unit can have hundreds of different landowners.
Then you have to have the agreement of all of the landowners in order to cobble together the rights to drill.
She says the problem for energy companies like Chesapeake and for people who want to lease their land comes when other landowners in the unit, like Patrick Hunkler and Gene Bax, say no to drilling.
It's almost like a veto, a single landowner being able to veto the ability of all the surrounding landowners to drill.
And to make money from the oil and gas. In Ohio, if a company gets 65% of landowners in a unit to agree to lease their mineral rights, it can use that unitization law to force unwilling landowners into leases. Since 2011, ODNR has approved 144 forced leases or unitizations through hearings in Columbus, like this one.
This hearing before the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas Resources Management.
At this hearing, energy company Ascent Resources brought a geologist, an engineer, and a land agent to testify, along with a slew of attorneys. The company engineer testifies that Ascent's project is a $20 million investment. He says without the unleased tracts of land, the company would lose the ability to collect so much gas that the project would no longer be financially viable.
That would be the difference likely in what would be a project that Ascent Resources would pursue versus what we would not pursue.
The profitability of the project is the basis of whether ODNR issues a unitization order and forces holdout landowners to lease with the company. At Chesapeake Energy's unitization hearings against his family, Patrick Hunkler asked the state to also consider his environmental concerns. But transcripts of Hunkler's hearings show ODNR told him they had no authority to consider that.
Hey, ODNR, we have concerns about our natural resources. Who can we talk to? They didn't listen to us in the hearing.
But Mark Bruce, administrative officer with ODNR, says the unitization process allows citizens to comment.
Mineral owners have an opportunity to be heard verbally or in writing during the process, and their comments are always considered.
But the state has never ruled against an energy company in a unitization hearing. Bruce says that's because companies only apply once they've met the state requirements.
The law specifically states that the division must issue an order if the applicant meets the criteria defined by the Ohio General Assembly.
Attorney Megan Hunter, who represented Patrick Hunkler and Gene Bax, says state law has been changed numerous times in recent years to favor energy companies over holdout landowners.
One side is really well represented, and the government is often aligned with them in these administrative forums, and the citizen is left to fend for themselves.
Last year, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources did issue orders for Chesapeake to unitize Hunkler and Bax's property. But after constructing the well pad nearby, the company abruptly sold all its Ohio assets, leaving the couple wondering what will happen next. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
And Julie's story was supported by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.